Oh, okay. Ladies and gentlemen, Eddie Chumney.
Well, thank you once again for giving me the opportunity to share with you what I regard is a vitally important message for the hour in which we are living. As I mentioned in my last message, I'm going to be doing a four-part series at this conference. In part, it will give you a background of understanding why Yeshua died on the tree, which I covered in the last session. And it'll also give you a background of understanding the two houses and their prophecies to become one. And I'm ultimately going to be focusing and explaining to you how this is prophesied to happen. I believe in this session I'm going to be sharing with you, before I actually get into the prophecies themselves, I'm going to be laying the foundation so that for the new people who are here, so that you can understand that these prophecies relate and pertain to you and not them. And so, this is part two of a four-part series, and everything that I'm going to be presenting to you this session, the last two sessions, I have available on a DVD called Hebraic Bible Prophecy back at the marketplace, and of course you'll have to get that after Sabbath is over now. But let's begin. And we're going to begin with Matthew chapter 11, beginning in verse 1, where John sends two of his disciples, and he asks Yeshua whether he is the Messiah or not. It is about 7:15. How long do I have so I can gauge my time as I'm giving this presentation? All night, huh? All night long. Okay. Well, I think the schedule says 7:30 to 9, so okay, you'll get a lot here. Okay. It came to pass when Yeshua had made an end of commanding his 12 disciples, he departed thence to teach and to preach in their cities. Now when John had heard in the prison the works of Messiah, he sent two of his disciples and he said, "Are you he that should come?" Or in other words, "Are you the Messiah? Or do we look for someone else who is the Messiah?" The answer that Yeshua gives is his biblical claim that he is the Messiah. And Yeshua answers this way. He said, "Go and show John again those things which you do hear and see." That is... Let's get handling of technology here. I don't know why it's going slow and fast at the same time. Okay, the blind receive their sight, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. Now, Yeshua's answer comes from Isaiah in chapter 35 is what he is quoting. In Isaiah chapter 35, at the end of the chapter, it is speaking of the ransomed of Yahweh coming to Zion. That is the exiles of Israel coming to Zion. And in their return to Zion, that is the end of the exile, they're described as being blind and lame. This describes their spiritual status. Now, we have recorded in Yeshua's earthly ministry that he literally healed the blind, caused the lame to walk, cleansed the lepers, caused the deaf to hear, raised the dead, and he preached the gospel to the outcasts of society. That is the poor, or the poor in spirit. However, I want to show you that this is not only literal, but these terms, the blind, the lame, the lepers, the deaf, the dead, and the poor, are all terms that describe the spiritual status of the exiles of Israel. So, translating his answer is the following: are you the Messiah? Yes, I am the Messiah, because I'm the one that gathers the exiles of Israel. And then he says, blessed is he that is not offended in me. Why did he add those words, blessed is he that's not offended in me? Because today Judaism and Christianity are offended that Yeshua is the Messiah who gathers the exiles of Israel. Judaism doesn't recognize that he's the Messiah. They're offended at the thought that he is the Messiah. And Christianity is offended at the thought that somehow the redemptive work of Messiah has something to do with the covenant promises he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and the promises and the covenant that was made at Mount Sinai. Because I have a separate teaching that shows that Yeshua is the one that gave the Torah at Mount Sinai. The Father willed it, but Yeshua gave it. There's a verse in the New Testament. James chapter 4, verse 12 says, there is one lawgiver who is able to save. And Christianity is offended that Yeshua is the lawgiver, and that the way you express your faith in him is by following the Torah. Now we're going to look at biblical terms which describe the exiles of Israel. The exiles of Israel are regarded as being deaf and blind. Isaiah chapter 42, verses 18 and 19, and verse 24, it is written, hear ye deaf, and look ye blind, that ye may see. Who is blind but my servant, or deaf as my messenger that I sent? Who is blind as he that is perfect, and is blind as Yahweh's servant? Who is called deaf and blind? Who is the servant of Yahweh? It's Jacob. Who gave Jacob for a spoil and Israel to the robbers? Who are the robbers? They are those who came and exiled the nation of Israel. Those are the robbers. Did not Yahweh, he against whom we have sinned, in other words, they wouldn't follow his Torah, broke the covenant at Mount Sinai, for they would not walk in his ways, neither were they obedient unto his Torah. That's Hebrew parallelism. Obedient to his Torah is walking in his ways. Okay, the exiles of Israel are regarded as being blind and lame, as we see in Jeremiah chapter 31, verses 7 and 8. For thus says Yahweh, sing with gladness for Jacob, and say the following, save your people, the remnant of Israel. So it's talking about gathering the remnant of Israel. And it says, I will bring them from the north country and gather them from the coast of the earth, and with them the blind and the lame. When he's gathered from the coast of the earth, when he's gathering the exiles of Israel, they're regarded as being blind and lame. I don't know if this has got a dead battery or what, but it's not going very well. Okay, Isaiah chapter 49, verses 13 and 14. The exiles of Israel are regarded as being poor and afflicted. It is written, sing, O heavens, and be joyful, O earth, and break forth into singing, O mountains, for Yahweh has comforted his people. He will have mercy upon his afflicted. His the afflicted? Zion. But Zion said. Zion, and that is the term for the exiles of Israel gathered in the end of days, they're regarded as being afflicted. We can see this in Isaiah chapter 60, verses 1 and 2 and verse 14, which says, arise, shine, for your light is come, and the glory of Yahweh is risen upon you. Then it says, the sons also of them that afflicted you shall come bending unto you, and all they that despised you shall bow themselves. So, The glory of Yahweh is being risen upon Zion, who is afflicted. Because at the end of Isaiah 60, verse 14, it says, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel. We can see this in Zephaniah chapter 3, verse 12, verse 14, and verse 20. I will leave in the midst of you an afflicted and poor people. Who's this? Sing, O daughter of Zion. It's the exiles gathered. Verse 20. I will gather you. I will make you a name and a praise among all people of the earth when I turn back your captivity. What period of time does Yahweh make Israel a name and a praise in the earth? We call it the Messianic era. So the end of the exile is a Messianic era event. Israel is regarded as being likened unto an unclean woman. Ezekiel chapter 36, verse 17. Son of man, when the house of Israel dwelt in their own land, they defiled it by their own way and by their doings. Their way was before me as the uncleanness of a removed woman. Remember, in the Gospels, the woman with the issue of blood, she is a spiritual picture of the nation of Israel in exile. The exiles of Israel are regarded as being dead. Ezekiel chapter 37, verses 1 through 3. The hand of Yahweh was upon me, and he carried me out in the spirit of Yahweh, and he set me in the midst of the valley, which was full of bones. The bones were very dry, and he said to me, Son of man, can these bones live? And he goes on to say that, I want to go once, it goes twice. Prophesy and say to these bones, O you dry bones, hear the word of Yahweh. And he says in verse 11, those bones are the whole house of Israel. So the exiles of Israel are likened unto dry bones. The exiles of Israel are regarded as being near and far off in their exile. 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 46. If they sin against you, for there is no man that sins not, and you be angry with them and deliver them to the enemy, so that they carry them away captive into the land of the enemy, captive into the land of the enemy, far or near. Daniel chapter 9, verse 7. O Yahweh, righteousness belongs unto you, but unto us confusion of face as it is this day, to the men of Judah and to the inhabitants of Jerusalem, that would be the southern kingdom, and all Israel, now that's referring to the northern kingdom, that are near and far off throughout all the countries where you've driven them. In Ephesians chapter 2, Paul uses these terms near and far off and said those who are near and far off are made near by the blood of Messiah. And he made of the two, those near and far off, one new man. Yeah. It's working better now. Deuteronomy 32, verse 26 and verse 30. The exiles of Israel are sold into the nations. I said I would scatter them into the corners. How should one chase 1,000 and two put 10,000 to flight except their rock had sold them? Who is the rock? The rock is the Messiah. So because the Messiah is the one that gave the Torah and entered into marriage at Mount Sinai with the house of Jacob, when they became disobedient, he sold them into the nations. And guess what? If he was able to sell them, he's able to buy them back. The purchase back is the redemption. We can see how the exiles of Israel have been sold in the nations. Isaiah 50, verse 1. Which of my creditors is it to whom I have sold you? Behold, for your iniquities have you sold yourselves, and for your transgressions is your mother put away. Thus says Yahweh, you have sold yourselves for naught, but you shall be redeemed without money. You will be redeemed without money. So how are the exiles of Israel redeemed? Zechariah chapter 9, verse 9 talks about your king will come unto you riding upon a donkey. And speaking about the king that comes upon you riding upon a donkey, Zechariah chapter 9, verse 11, it says, "As for you, by the blood of the covenant, by the blood of the covenant, have I sent forth your prisoners out of the pit, wherein there is no water." Who is the prisoners in the pit? Verse 13, "When I bent Judah for me and filled the bow with Ephraim." The prisoners are the exiles of Israel. Who are they imprisoned to? They are imprisoned to the robbers, those who took them captive. But he says, by the blood of the covenant is how you are going to come out of your prison. Let's look at a summary of terms which describe the exiles of Israel. They're regarded as being deaf, blind, lame, poor, leprous, dry bones, poor, and needy. Now, if you can understand that in the Hebrew Scriptures, these are biblical terms that describes the spiritual status of the exiles of Israel, you should know your New Testament well enough and the Gospels well enough that when Yeshua is dealing with the deaf, blind, lame, poor, leprous, dry bones, poor, and needy, he's not only dealing with literal people with this condition, this is also him prophesying and declaring what he is going to do unto the exiles of Israel. Now you can read your Gospels, and because much of Yeshua's ministry deals with him ministering to these types and groups of people, now you're going to see this is all him teaching and explaining how he deals and that he's going to heal the exiles of Israel. By understanding this, you can go from a Sunday church person thinking that, what? Two houses in the New Testament? I never even heard such a thing, let alone being in the New Testament. I've read my New Testament 100 times. I don't know that there's anything about two houses in the New Testament. It's because you don't understand what you're reading. Once you understand what you're reading, and that these terms refer to the exiles of Israel, all of a sudden, Brad, you realize that two houses is everywhere! The exiles of Israel are described as being afflicted, sick and wounded. I didn't cover this, but an adulterous wife. And this is a separate teaching by itself. It's an awesome and fascinating teaching. And that is, when Yeshua died on the tree, he died the death of the penalty of an adulterous woman. Who is that adulterous woman? The nation of Israel. He took upon himself her sins. The exiles of Israel are regarded as being an unclean woman, sold in the nations. The northern kingdom is far off in their exile. The southern kingdom is near in their exile. What is the gospel? It's the blind, that is the exiles of Israel, receive their sight. They receive their sight by understanding that Yeshua is the Messiah and they need to follow Torah. The lame, that is the exiles of Israel, walk. Walking means you follow Torah. The lepers, the exiles of Israel, are cleansed, meaning their sins are forgiven. He's got to forgive the sins of the exiles of Israel. The deaf, the exiles of Israel, hear. They understand that Yeshua is Messiah and they hear. Shema, they follow Torah. The dead, that is the exiles of Israel, scattered in the nations, are raised up. They're brought back from the nations of the world to the land of Israel. The poor, the exiles of Israel, why are they poor? Because they departed from Torah. They have the gospel preached to them. The gospel is the good news. What is the good news? Messiah's got to forgive you of your sins, and he's got to gather you back, and you'll rule and reign with him. And Yeshua gathers the exiles of Israel. Now, I'm going to share with you, who is the house of Jacob? Why is this important? Because we're told in Luke chapter 1, verse 33, that Yeshua will reign over the house of Jacob forever. And of his kingdom there will be no end. I personally, by being a believer in Yeshua as Messiah, being a member of his family, I believe that he's got to rule and reign over me forever. But this says that he's got to rule and reign over the house of Jacob forever. Does the Sunday church see itself as the house of Jacob? They see themselves as being members of the family of Messiah, but they don't see themselves as being the house of Jacob. But Messiah's got to rule over the house of Jacob forever. You know what that means? You better be a part of the house of Jacob or he's not going to rule and reign over you. But before you get too nervous about that statement, I have very good news. Whether you realize it or not, the name of your family in Messiah is the house of Jacob. You see, at Mount Sinai, Exodus chapter 19, the covenant was made with the house of Jacob. The new covenant is made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, who combined is the house of Jacob. And we are a part of that new covenant in Yeshua. The literal house of Jacob was at Mount Sinai, Exodus chapter 19, verse 3. Thus you shall say to the house of Jacob. But who is the house of Jacob? You see, let me tell you the confusion that is still in the family of Yahweh by not knowing who the house of Jacob is. You see, it's easier for Jews and even Christians to understand and to identify the Jewish people with the house of Jacob. That's not technically correct. The Jewish people are a part of the house of Jacob, but they're not totally the house of Jacob. Well, what happened was there was a part of Christianity that saw in the New Testament that in describing the quote-unquote church, that they're described as inheriting Yahweh's promises that He made in the Hebrew Scriptures. And by from seeing that and embracing it, they said, well, this belongs to us. And they added with it, because they already had a doctrine of dispensationalism, age of law, age of grace, and Old Testament, plan A, it failed. We had to go to plan B. And so they said that, therefore, God is no longer working with the Jewish people, and the Old Covenant has been done away with. We commonly call that replacement theology. You see, they understood that these promises are made to the family of Messiah, who they call themselves the church. But what they did is they took a valid truth and they mixed with it an error that Yahweh has done away with the covenants that He made in the what we call the Old Testament. And that error, it's a major, major error, that error caused what is regarded as evangelical Christianity to say, no, wait a second, we reject replacement theology, and you should reject replacement theology, but then they took the pendulum and they swung it the other way. And they said, well, you know, God still has covenant promises with what they call the Jewish people. It's really the house of Jacob. And that belongs to them. And we are separate and distinct. We are the church. And so you have evangelical Christianity. You have evangelical Christianity who often call themselves also Christian Zionists. We say, oh, we love the Jews. Let's give you some money and oh, we love you. And we love you, but we're going in the rapture. And the only difference between that and what used to be was, no, God's through with the Jews and we're going in the rapture. Both groups are going to the rapture. One just says, I love you before they go. And the missing thing that Christianity has missed is they don't know who Yeshua is. And commonly, When we are in the book of Genesis and we're talking about the creations of the heavens and the earth, you know what invariably what we say 99.9% of the time? When God created the heavens and the earth. And you know what we mean in our minds when we say when God created the heavens and the earth? We mean the Father. The irony about that is that it is explicitly stated in Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 and 16, that Yeshua created the heavens and the earth. You would have thought that somebody, well, remember yesterday, we hadn't made it through the book of John, even though we said we did. We kind of missed what it said in John 10 and John 11. Somehow we kind of missed Colossians chapter 1, too. Well, Yeshua created the heavens and the earth. And then, when we're in Genesis, we're talking about the covenant that was made with Abraham. You know what we invariably say 99.9% of the time? When God made covenant with Abraham. And what do we mean when God made covenant with Abraham? We mean the Father. Yet, in that book that we love to quote, Galatians, that we don't need to follow the law, it says in Galatians chapter 3, verse 16, that Messiah made the covenant with Abraham. Messiah made the covenant with Abraham. And then at Mount Sinai, we said, when God gave the law. And we mean the Father. Well, see, the Father willed all this, but He didn't do it. He gave it to the Son to do. He executed the will. But we're told in James chapter 4, verse 12, there's one lawgiver that's able to save. And the problem is, we don't recognize who Yeshua is. Now, when we say, when God redeemed the children of Israel out of Egypt, what do we mean? The Father. But the irony about that is, in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 4, it tells us in the coming out of Egypt that the one that was with them and followed them was the Messiah. So therefore, who made covenant with the house of Jacob at Mount Sinai? The Messiah. And so who renewed the covenant by dying on the tree? The Messiah. And because we've regarded as the Old Testament as Plan A, God the Father, and we paint in the Jews, and we put up a wall, and then now New Testament, Jesus, Plan B, and we separate the two in our minds, we haven't understood who the house of Jacob is. And so that's what we need to understand. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 4, Paul is writing primarily to non-Jewish believers, and he tells them the following. Moreover, brethren, I would not that you be ignorant. Don't be ignorant. By the way, you want to do an interesting Bible study? Find the places in the New Testament where it says don't be ignorant, and those are the exact places where we're ignorant. Here's one. Don't be ignorant that all our fathers were under the cloud, in that they all passed through the sea. And they were all baptized in the Moses, in the cloud, and in the sea. They did all eat the same spiritual meat. They did all drink the same spiritual drink. Now, it's a good thing Paul didn't take English class and English grammar, because he wouldn't have got a very good grade, because why does it take him so long to say something so simple, and in trying to say something, he keeps repeating the word all? Everyone knows that you don't keep repeating yourself if you're writing good English papers, right? You get to the point. Well, Paul is trying to make a point, because when he says don't be ignorant, he uses the word all five times regarding the coming out of Egypt, that all of our fathers did this. And then he goes on to say, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Messiah. So he says, all our fathers were under the cloud. Do you realize that's not literally true? My father and grandfather didn't come out of Egypt literally, and Paul's father and grandfather didn't literally come out of Egypt, but we're told, don't be ignorant, that all of our fathers did. And so he's telling believers in Messiah, don't be ignorant that you came out of Egypt. So, if all of our fathers passing through the sea is not literally true, then how can Paul state it then? The answer is that it's a Torah or a Hebraic concept. When what Paul is writing in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 4, he's actually quoting from the Torah. In Deuteronomy chapter 29, verses 12 through 15. Regarding the covenant that's being made at Mount Sinai, it says in verses 14 and 15, "Neither with you only do I make this covenant and this oath, but the covenant and the oath is being made with him that stands here with us this day before Yahweh our Elohim, and also with him that is not here with us this day." I want you to notice the covenant of Mount Sinai is being made with two groups of people. It's being made with those who are there, and it's also being made with those who are not there. So in other words, if you are not there, you are there. That is, if you believe in Yahweh and seek to be a part of His covenant family. Because the Torah says, even though you were not there, you were there. That's why He's speaking to an audience who wouldn't see it this way if they didn't know Torah, to don't be ignorant that all of our fathers were under the cloud and they all passed through the sea. Now in Exodus chapter 13, verse 8, it says, "You shall show your son in that day." When is in that day? In that day is in future generations. But also, in that day. What day? The Messianic era, the day of Yahweh. So it's even in the Messianic era, when Messiah is ruling and reigning, we are going to tell our sons that the reason why we're doing Passover is because of what Yahweh did for me when I came forth out of Egypt. That is a Torah commandment, to tell your son that he came out of Egypt. Do you realize the son in that day or in future generations, past the literal historical event, didn't literally come out of Egypt? But when you do Passover, if we do in the Passover this year, you're supposed to tell your son that that event that happened, it didn't just happen to them, it happened to you. Yahweh brought you out of there. So you're to see yourself as if you came out of Egypt, and that's what Paul is referring to. But do you realize the son in that day didn't literally come out of Egypt? Then why are we to tell him that he came out if he didn't literally come out? And the answer is because it is, you know what, I'm going to take up your offer. That is because it is a Torah concept, right? Well, in the next slide. Now, in Exodus chapter 19, it says that those who came to Mount Sinai were the house of Jacob. And also, if we, as believers in Messiah, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 1 through 4, if we are to see ourselves as if we came out of Egypt. When we came out of Egypt, you know where you and I went? We went to Mount Sinai. So that which happened at Mount Sinai, now I can't get it to go at all. You didn't put it in backwards, did you? That's something what I would do. I would put it in backwards. In Exodus chapter 19, those who came was the house of Jacob. Now, I always had a vision in my mind from going to Sunday school class, from watching like the Ten Commandments, that it was the Jews who came to Mount Sinai. Or I thought of it as the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. What I didn't realize is we're told in Exodus chapter 12, verses 37 and 38, that a mixed multitude went up with them. Who is this mixed multitude? It is the people who lived in Egypt who put the blood of the lamb upon the doorpost. Because you remember the decree that the firstborn would die was for the whole land of Egypt. Not just the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, but it was for the whole land of Egypt. And so those who were not physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob who did this, the Bible calls the mixed multitude. And those at Mount Sinai consisted of the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob who put the blood of the Lamb upon the doorpost, and the mixed multitude who put the blood of the Lamb upon the doorpost. And together, they're referred to as the house of Jacob. But wait a second. How does the mixed multitude who are not physical descendants of the Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, how do they become a part of the house of Jacob? The answer is they're regarded as being strangers, sojourners, adopted, or grafted in. So the Torah teaches us when the God of Israel redeems his people, remembering the covenant he made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, that he allows those who receive and want to participate in the redemption to be grafted into the redemptive work. That's not a New Testament concept. It comes from the redemption from Egypt. Now, did the God of Israel say, okay, Moses, the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I want you to set them on one side, and the mixed multitude, I want you to set them on another side, because the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, I have a whole lot of commandments to share with them. It's going to take a little bit of time, 613. But you know what? I'm going to make it a little bit easier on the mixed multitude. I only have two for them. That is, they love Yahweh, they love everybody else. Is that what happened? No, what happened was, Numbers 15, verses 15 and 16. One ordinance shall be for you of the congregation, that is the physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and also for the stranger that sojourns with you. In this case, it's the mixed multitude. That there's one ordinance for you of the congregation and the stranger is to be an ordinance forever. One Torah in one manner shall be for you and for the stranger that sojourns with you. Notice the ordinance is to be forever, which kind of begs the question, how long is forever? Now, you guys can decide for yourself what you think forever means, but I think it means forever. But I was taught that whatever was said forever only was, in the Hebrew Scriptures, it was only until Yeshua died on the tree. And then those forevers wasn't valid anymore. But if he said forever after he died on the tree, you can bet it's forever. Now, you know who today doesn't believe that there's one Torah for all those who believe in Yahweh, in our covenant relationship with Yahweh Yeshua? Well, Judaism doesn't believe it. They say, no, the Torah is just for Jews. You know, if you're non-Jewish, you don't need to do that. Yah made it easier for you. Take the easy route. You don't want to punish yourself by taking the hard route, dude. Make it easy. They call it the Noahide laws. So, you know, they don't believe there's one Torah for those who believe in Yahweh. Well, Christianity doesn't either, because they say, well, no, we only have two to follow. We love Yahweh and we love everybody else. And, you know, Yeshua died on the tree to do away with the Torah. So they don't believe it. Well, Messianic Judaism doesn't believe it either. They say the Torah is just for Jewish believers. But if you're a non-Jewish believer, you don't need to follow the Torah. You know, it's go ahead. Go ahead and eat a pig and celebrate Christmas and Easter. It's okay for you to do that. Those other things of keeping the Sabbath and the festivals, that's just for Jews. So they don't believe it either. And so, like, how come everyone has such a difficult time understanding that one Torah is for you or the congregation and the stranger, and that is to be an ordinance forever? In the Hebrew Roots movement, we're trying to get people to understand that there's one Torah. Now, how was the house of Jacob redeemed from Egypt? It was by grace through faith. And they did it by putting the blood of the Lamb upon the doorpost. Why was that such an act of faith? Because in Egyptian society, a lamb was one of their gods. And so, killing what your neighbor may think of their god is not politically correct. So you better be sure that Yahweh said to kill that lamb, or else, you're going to be a right-wing extremist. So being saved by grace through faith is a Torah concept. It is not something that is new to the New Testament. Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8. By grace are you saved through faith. It is the gift of Elohim. So salvation by grace through faith is how Yahweh redeemed His people from Egypt. You see, it was by grace because they didn't deserve it. It was by faith because you had to put the blood of the Lamb upon the doorpost. Even though His grace was present, if you didn't put the blood of the Lamb upon the doorpost, then even though His grace was there, grace wasn't enough. It required faith as well. Now, those who were saved by grace through faith are the people who came to Mount Sinai. And at Mount Sinai, they were given commandments on how to live their lives as a redeemed people. You see, Yahweh didn't require that they keep all the commandments and then He would redeem His people from Egypt. The commandments were given after they were saved by grace through faith. Now, in Romans chapter 3, verse 31, Paul says, do we make void the Torah through faith? You know what's interesting? Romans chapter 3, verse 23 is a pretty famous verse. For all have sinned and fallen short of the glory of Yahweh. If everyone is somewhat familiar with that verse, how come they don't know what appears eight verses later? Do we make void the Torah through faith? Elohim forbid, we establish the Torah. You see, everyone can know somehow that Paul supposedly made an argument in Galatians that we're not supposed to follow the law, but he asked the question and he answered it in Romans 3:31. Do we make void the Torah through faith? Elohim forbid, we establish the Torah. And if by chance we might miss that one verse, perhaps we might have read the book of Acts. Because in Acts chapter 17, Paul is accused of not teaching Torah, and he's accused of himself that he didn't follow Torah. I believe that's Acts 21. I think I said Acts 17. That's Acts 21. Then from Acts 21 through Acts 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, we got entire chapters on Paul's defense that he did follow Torah. So if we have over five chapters in Galatians, I'm sorry, over five chapters in the book of Acts, where Paul is defending that he kept Torah, why do we think that he said in Galatians we don't? We pick and choose, and the people in the pews don't know their Bibles well enough to know that Paul testified that he kept Torah in the book of Acts. They don't know their Bibles well enough to know that he said in Romans 3:31, do we make void the Torah through because of being saved by grace through faith? He says, no, we don't. We establish the Torah. And so, we generally believe what we've been taught and what we've heard, rather than knowing the Scriptures for ourselves. Now in John 1:29, Yochanan, John the Immerser, said, behold, the Lamb of Elohim, that is Yeshua, who takes away the sins of the world. And then in John chapter 14, verse 15,
Yeshua said, if you love me, keep my commandments. You know how challenging it has been for Christianity to understand what Yeshua meant by, if you love me, keep my commandments? They said, commandments, commandments. What in the world is a commandment? I'm not quite sure I know what a commandment is. I think we need to form a committee and study this out a little bit and try to figure out what Yeshua meant. I got it. The committee comes back and says, I think he means we're supposed to love Yahweh and love everyone else. I think what that means. Well, think about that for a second. Imagine that I'm Moses, and I've been on Mount Sinai, and I say the words, I have commandments for you from Yahweh. Would there anyone not know what Moses is talking about when he says, I have commandments? How come if one greater than Moses, that is Yeshua the Messiah, says, keep my commandments, people go, a commandment? I'm not quite sure what a commandment is. I definitely don't think it's Torah. But notice he didn't say, if you want to be saved, keep my commandment. He said, if you love me. Love is something that happens in a relationship. Love is something that you do when you get to know somebody else. So if you want to get to know who Yeshua is, if you really want to not just say I love him, but demonstrate you love him, you do so by keeping his commandments. Furthermore, when Yeshua said, if you love me, keep my commandments, he was quoting from Exodus chapter 20. That is the chapter on the giving of the Ten Commandments. And the one who's giving the commandment says in Exodus chapter 20, verse 6, I show mercy. You know what mercy is? It's grace. I show mercy to thousands of them that love me and keep my commandments. The first occurrence of the phrase love me and keep my commandments in the Bible is at Mount Sinai about keeping the Torah. So Yeshua said, if you love me, keep my commandments. He's referring to the Torah that he gave at Mount Sinai. Because in James chapter 4, verse 12, it says, there's one lawgiver who is able to save. Who's the one that's able to save? It's Yeshua. He is the lawgiver. Now, the house of Jacob was divided into two kingdoms. And in order to understand this, it's important to understand that it was Jacob's name that was changed to Israel. It was not Judah's name that was changed to Israel. Because today, when the Bible's referring to the house of Jacob, we refer to, oh, that's the Jews. And we like to say, you know, Abraham was the first Jew. And the Jews say Abraham was a Jew. Abraham wasn't a Jew. He was a Hebrew. One that crossed over is what Hebrew means. Then you have Isaac. He's a Hebrew. Then you have Jacob. His name was changed to Israel. So Jacob is a Hebrew and he's an Israelite. One of the sons of Jacob is Judah. It's Judah from where we get Jews. So Judah is a Jew, an Israelite, and a Hebrew. Judah is the first Jew in the Bible. So the house of Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, was divided into northern kingdom and southern kingdom. The southern kingdom took its name from the leading tribe, that is the tribe of Judah, and that southern kingdom became known as Jews. The northern kingdom, the leading tribe, was Ephraim, and they are Israelites. They are Israelites. Some of the names for the northern kingdom in the Bible, they were called the house of Israel, Ephraim, the house of Joseph, and they set up their capital in Samaria. The southern kingdom is known as the house of Judah. Now, all Jews are Israelites because those of the southern kingdom, they're Jewish and they're also Israelites. They're from the house of Jacob. It was Jacob's name he changed to Israel. But while all Jews are Israelites, not all Israelites are Jews. Because the northern kingdom are Israelites because they come from the house of Jacob, but they are not Jews. The northern kingdom was taken captive by the Assyrians. And here we have the first taking in 2 Kings chapter 15, verse 29. And here we're told that Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, came and took various places in Gilead and Galilee. He took Gilead and Galilee. So the first taking of any of the 12 tribes was from the area of Gilead and Galilee, which was the land that was given to the tribe of Naphtali. Now, if Messiah is going to come to repair the breach is the breaking of the covenant, and he's going to forgive the sins of the 12 tribes, and he's going to gather them, in order to repair something that was broken, he's got to go to the place where it was broken. And where was the initial captivity? It was from the Galilee. That is why his ministry is in the Galilee. It is a statement that his focus is upon gathering the northern kingdom, in addition to the southern kingdom. Now, the southern kingdom was taken captive by the Babylonians in Nebuchadnezzar. 2 Kings 24, verse 10 and verse 15. The northern kingdom was involved in what the author of 1 Kings writes as a golden calf system of worship. And the first king of the northern kingdom is Jeroboam. And it says in 1 Kings 12, 28, the king took counsel. You know what he did? He looked at the situation with his natural eyes and with his human agenda. What was his human agenda? He wanted to be king. But he had a rival, and that was Rehoboam of the southern kingdom. And Jerusalem, where the Torah says you're supposed to go three times a year to keep a feast unto Yahweh, was under the jurisdiction of Rehoboam. Well, Jeroboam didn't want the people who were under him becoming friends with those who was being ruled by Rehoboam. So therefore, he said, you know, if they go to Jerusalem, that's not good for me. They could show their allegiance to Rehoboam and not me. And so he took counsel and he says, we're going to go to a different place than Jerusalem. It's too much for you to go to Jerusalem. Behold your gods, O Israel, which brought you up out of the land of Egypt. So he made an alternative place of worship. One was in Bethel and the other was Dan. Bethel means the house of El, the house of Elohim. Dan comes from the Hebrew word din, which means the judge. I see in these two places a prophecy. They called their place of worship the house of Elohim, but it was going to be judged. And it was ultimately judged. Now, to most easily understand the connection between the Northern Kingdom, the New Testament, and the ministry of Yeshua, we need to understand the book of Hosea. And in Hosea chapter 1, we're told that Hosea marries a whore by the name of Gomer. And there are three children that are mentioned from this marriage in Hosea chapter 1. The first is Jezreel. Jezreel means El will sow or El will scatter. The judgment upon the northern kingdom is they were going to be scattered into the nations of the world. The second child mentioned, Hosea 1:6, is Lo Ruhamah. Lo in Hebrew is not. Ruhamah is mercy. So the second child is named No Mercy. The third child is named Lo Ami. Lo in Hebrew is not. Am is people. Ami is my people. So the third child is named Not My People. How many of you know that if Yahweh said, I'm going to scatter you, and I'm not going to show you mercy, and you're not my people, that's not good news? No, that's not good news. But if you notice how Yahweh deals with His people, He does according to this principle. He will rebuke them, and after He rebukes them, He gives them words of encouragement. And that's how we are supposed to instruct our children. If we rebuke them, say, you should not be doing this, it should end with, but I still love you. And in Revelation chapter 2 and 3 to the seven churches, it says, this is what I have against you. You do this wrong and that wrong and that wrong. But then he says, but he who overcomes. So here, after he's saying, no mercy, not my people, yet the number of the children of Israel shall be as the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. This is a promise that was made to Abraham. In other words, it's being said, is through the judgment that comes upon the northern kingdom is the way in which he's going to fulfill the covenant that was made with Abraham. It will come to pass in the place that was said, you are not my people. Where is it said you are not my people? Right here in the judgment. That it will be said, you are the sons of the living Elohim. Who is the son of the living Elohim? John 1:12. As many as received him, that is Yeshua, to them gave he power to become the sons of Elohim, even them that believe on his name. So we have a prophecy that the northern kingdom would become believers in Yeshua as the Messiah. That's why Yeshua said in John chapter 10, verse 16, other sheep I have, which are not of this fold, they will hear my voice. It's the fulfillment of the prophecy of the northern kingdom that they would be believers in Yeshua, sons of the living Elohim. Hosea chapter 2, verse 23 is another prophecy. I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. And I will say to her which were not my people, you are my people, and they will say, you are my Elohim. You see this phrase, you are my people, and I will be their Elohim? There's another verse that says that. This is wedding talk. You are my people, and I will be your Elohim. So he's going to take them from being exiled to be redeemed, to be sins forgiven, and take the exiles back as his bride. Now, what we have prophesied in Hosea chapter 1 is quoted in 1 Peter and in Romans by Paul. And so, both Paul and Peter knew not only where the northern kingdom was, and Stephen Collins has done a great job of giving us historical detail about that. Not only did he know where they were, but he knew that they were believers in Yeshua, and Yeshua had commissioned to go out unto them and to proclaim Yeshua and following Torah. Now in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 5, it says, you are lively stones, built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to Elohim by Yeshua HaMashiach. Now verse 10 is quoting Hosea chapter 1. Peter is writing this letter and he's saying to his audience, you in time past were not a people. Who in time past was not a people? The northern kingdom. Hosea 1:9, lo ami. But you are now the people of Elohim. How did they become the people of Elohim? They believed in Yeshua. You had not obtained mercy. That's Hosea 1:6. No mercy, lo ruhama. But you now have obtained mercy. How did they obtain mercy? Yeshua died on the tree, shed his blood for the forgiveness of their sins. You have obtained mercy. Now, furthermore, Peter knows where the northern kingdom are when he writes his letter. It says, Peter, an apostle of Yeshua HaMashiach, to the strangers scattered. Who's scattered in the nations? It's the exiles of Israel. They're scattered in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia. And these areas is what we call Asia Minor. Well, if Peter says that the strangers scattered, the northern kingdom, are in Galatia, didn't Paul write a letter to the Galatians? What's the probability he's addressing the northern kingdom in Galatia? Well, guess what? In Galatia, the northern kingdom is going to be with Judah. Judah's got to be in Asia Minor as well. There's got to be some of Judah there. How do we know? Because Paul was going from place to place, and there were synagogues in the places where he went. So Judah was at the places where he traveled unto. But what is the issue that the northern kingdom's got to have being around Judah and probably being influenced by Judah? Because Judah's following doesn't believe that Yeshua is the Messiah, and they're following rabbinic Judaism. And so, does Paul want a believer in Yeshua to follow rabbinic Judaism or the Torah of Messiah as he correctly gave it and interpreted it through the help and the inspiration of the Holy Spirit? Yeah, that's what he wants. And so, therefore, there's some in the northern kingdom who is following rabbinic Judaism, and that's those strong rebukes that Paul has in Galatians, in the book of Galatians. Those are the strong rebukes that he has. And he uses the phrase, under the law. He's referring to those who are seeking to follow rabbinic Judaism and not following Yeshua, the lawgiver. And that's what the book of Galatians is about. Now, it says, to the stranger scattered, elect. Who in the Bible is regarded as being elect? It is the nation of Israel. They're elect according to the foreknowledge of Elohim the Father through the sanctification of the Spirit unto obedience and the sprinkling of the blood of Yeshua HaMashiach. Notice what he's saying about the northern kingdom, that they're elect through the sanctification of the Spirit by obedience in the blood of Yeshua. Now, how do we know he's addressing the northern kingdom? Because in 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 13, it says, the church, the word church is in italics, it's not in the Greek text, the at Babylon, elected together with you. So he's writing to the elect in Pontus, Galatia, Cappadocia, Asia, Bithynia, but he's also saying that you have somebody that is elected with you that is in Babylon. Well, who's in Babylon? Judah's in Babylon, and they're also elect with the northern kingdom. And it says, they at Babylon who are elected together salute you. So we see that the book of 1 Peter here is written to the northern kingdom. Now, in 1 Peter 1, 2, it says, you are elect. Who is elect? It's the nation of Israel. Isaiah 45, 4. For Jacob my servant's sake, in Israel my elect. 1 Peter 2, 9, it says, you are a chosen generation, a peculiar people. Well, in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verse 6, the nation of Israel is called a chosen and special or peculiar people. You are a holy people unto Yahweh your Elohim. Yahweh your Elohim has chosen you to be a special people unto himself above all people that are on the face of the earth. Now, 1 Peter 1:10, it says, the prophets prophesied of the grace that would come unto you. Well, let me give you two places where the prophets prophesied of grace that would come to the northern kingdom. Jeremiah 31:20, is Ephraim my dear son? Ephraim is the northern kingdom. I will have mercy upon him, says Yahweh. Hosea 2:23, I will sow her unto me in the earth, and I will have mercy upon her that had not obtained mercy. So, you know, Brad, you know, you came up to me, you know, that conference there in Tampa, and you said, two house, what's this two house? This is heresy. You remember what I said? It's everywhere. Well, you know, I showed you biblical terms for the exiles of Israel, and so we can see how Messiah's ministry in the Gospels is centered on this subject. Now we're looking at some of the epistles and seeing it's also centered on this subject. So we go from not even thinking it's in the New Testament, not even an issue, something that, you know, weird people come up with that wants to distract the true people that follow Yeshua, to realizing, my goodness, it is central and one of the main themes of the New Testament. 1 Peter 1:18, for as much as you know that you were not redeemed with corruptible things as silver and gold from your vain conversation received by tradition from your fathers. What's the tradition of your fathers? The oral law. He's saying, now you know you are not saved by the tradition of your fathers, by following the oral law or rabbinic Judaism. That's not what saved you. You're saved by the precious blood of Messiah as a lamb without blemish and without spot. Then it says in 1 Peter 2:25, you were as sheep going astray. Whom the Bible's called sheep? The nation of Israel. How did you go astray? You quit following Torah. You were going astray, but you've returned. Notice they didn't come for the first time. They returned to the shepherd. How did they return to the shepherd? Because it's the shepherd who brought them out of Egypt and gave them the Torah at Mount Sinai. And by departing from Torah, they departed from the shepherd. But the shepherd died on the tree to forgive them of their sins. And when they received what he did, they're returning to the shepherd. And it's the nation of Israel who's regarded as being lost sheep. Jeremiah 50, verse 17. Israel is a scattered sheep. Now, Paul understood this, and he writes, and he's referring to the northern kingdom and their role and interaction compared to the southern kingdom, in Romans chapter 9 through 11. So let's look at that. Romans 9, 24. Even us whom he's called, not of the Jews only, but also of the Gentiles, as he said in Hosea. Did you catch that? Of the Gentiles, as he says in Hosea. Of the Gentiles, as he says in Hosea. Wait a second. Hosea wasn't written to the northern. Hosea wasn't written to the Gentiles. It was written to the northern kingdom. You can't say the Gentiles, as it says in Hosea, because Hosea was written to the northern kingdom. It wasn't written to the Gentiles. So context tells you that word Gentile in this particular verse is referring to the northern kingdom. Because they became scattered or sown in the nations, and they took upon themselves the characteristics of the people who they intermarried with. As he says in Hosea, I will call them my people which were not my people, and her beloved which were not my beloved. Hosea 2:23. It will come to pass in the place that was said, you are not my people, there they will be called the children of the living Elohim. Hosea chapter 1, verse 10. Romans 10, 19, Paul goes on to say, but I say, did not Israel know? Now, context tells you that that word Israel is referring to Judah. And I'll show you how. For Moses said, I will provoke you to jealousy by them that are no people, and by a foolish nation will I anger you. Did not Israel know? They should have known because Moses first prophesied of something. He's quoting Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 21, which is called the second song of Moses. It says, they have moved me to jealousy by that which is not Elohim. They provoked me to anger with their vanities. And here's the prophecy. I will move them to jealousy with not a people. The prophecy, he's got to move somebody to jealousy by somebody else who's not going to be a people. It wasn't until Hosea that the northern kingdom became not a people. And so Paul is looking in the Torah and he's saying, now listen, Judah should have known that the northern kingdom was not going to be a people because there's the prophecy in Deuteronomy 32. But then he quotes from the prophet, Isaiah, and says, Isaiah is very bold and said, I was found of them that sought me not. I was made manifest unto them that asked not after me. He's quoting Isaiah 65:1. I am found of them that sought me not. I said, behold me unto a nation not called by my name. What nation was it called by his name? The northern kingdom. They were called not a people. Now, Paul goes on to explain in Romans 11, has Elohim cast away his people? This is interesting. Paul is saying, has he cast away his people? And he answers it. Elohim forbid. Yet, traditional Christianity, there's an element of traditional Christianity that says, oh yeah, God's done with the Jews. You know, that was the old covenant. And they blew it. And he doesn't care about, what was done back then. I mean, like, there's the question. Has he cast away his people? No. I mean, how do you misunderstand that? Well, I think you need help. He says, I am an Israelite of the seed of Abraham, of the tribe of Benjamin. So I say, okay, have they stumbled that they should fall? Did Judah stumble? Did they stumble at Messiah that they would fall, that there's no hope for them? Elohim forbid. No, they didn't stumble they should fall. But it was through their fall, not accepting Yeshua as the Messiah, that salvation has come unto the Gentiles to provoke them to jealousy. Salvation came unto who? The northern kingdom. And also, as an extension, the entire world. And here Paul is explaining the role that the northern kingdom has. It's to provoke Judah to jealousy, fulfilling what it says in the Torah, Deuteronomy 32:21. Now he says, now look what he says here. He says, if through their fall, salvation has come to the northern kingdom, I mean, that's a positive thing, and unto all the world, right? Because when he redeems his people, he makes that redemption available to all the whosoevers. He says, if the fall of them be the riches of the world, and the diminishing of them the riches of the Gentiles, what will be the case when they believe he's the Messiah? And here's the answer. If the casting away, Romans 11:15, be the reconciliation of the world, what shall be the receiving of them? Here's the answer. Life from the dead. What will happen when they believe that Yeshua is the Messiah? Life from the dead. Which begs the question, who's dead? It is the exiles of Israel. You remember Ezekiel chapter 37? The dry bones? The question is, can these bones live? Right? Can these bones live? Those bones are the whole house of Israel. And he says, those dry bones, he says, I will open your graves and cause you to come up out of your graves. That's the nations of the world outside the land of Israel. And I will bring you into the land of Israel. And now look at this. And you will know that I am Yahweh when I opened up your graves and bring you back to the land of Israel. They're going to know who is Yahweh. They're going to know that Yeshua is Yahweh when he unites both houses of Israel and brings them back to the land. That's what Paul was referring to, life from the dead. The dead, the dry bones. Life, breath being breathed in them, being brought into their own land. So Paul knew exactly when the two houses were going to come together. It was going to happen at the end of days. And when it happened, the northern kingdom was going to provoke Judah to jealousy. Well, what would the northern kingdom have to do to provoke Judah to jealousy? They have to, at minimum, keep the Torah. So, you know, Paul knew these prophecies. He was a scholar of Torah, and he was a scholar of the prophets, the Hebrew Scriptures. And he's writing and explaining these things. And he knew he wouldn't live to see this. That's why he said he was born out of his time. And he knew that this was such a fabulous event to witness. And you know what? I don't know why this is the case, but you and I have been born in this generation and we're going to witness it. The literal house of Jacob is likened to an olive tree. Jeremiah 11:16. A green olive tree Yahweh has called you, and the branches of it are broken. This green olive tree is the house of Israel and the house of Judah. So we have the house of Israel, the house of Judah, who's a green olive tree, and their branches are broken. Now how in the world are these broken branches going to be mended? That's what Paul explains here in Romans chapter 11. Now, when it's talking about this olive tree, it's talking about the literal house of Jacob, consisting of the literal house of Israel and the literal house of Judah. Now, in Romans 11, this olive tree in Messiah consists of wild branches and natural branches. Now, what we miss when we read Romans 11, because, you see, it's been emphasized to us that the non-Jews have been grafted in, and by the way, they have been grafted in. That's a Romans chapter 11, verse 17. But I'm going to show you right here that while we're pretty familiar that the Gentiles are grafted in, what we don't realize is 7 verses later, Romans 11:24, that says that when the natural branches believe, they're grafted in too. And I have seen more than one, believe me, more than one, people who come out of the church, Sunday church, embrace Hebrew roots, and they identify with Torah, and for some reason, they don't know their Bible well enough, and they have an inferiority complex, and they think that Yahweh just doesn't think too much of them, because even though they're following Torah, you know, he just likes the Jews better than us. And so, you know what? I really want him to like me as much as he likes the Jews, because I follow Torah and I want to follow Torah. And if I convert to Judaism, then he's really got to like me, because I'm following the truth now. Well, it says, if you were cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and you were grafted contrary to nature into a good olive tree, how much more shall these, which be the natural branches, be grafted into their own olive tree? I want you to notice that both the wild branches and the natural branches are grafted in. There's no difference between the two. They're both grafted in. The only way that you can become a member of the family of the Messiah is to be grafted in. Now, I'm going to give you a huge, huge clue right now regarding understanding the end of days events, which I'm going to be going over and explaining to you the details of how the two houses are going to come together, when they're going to come together, and the circumstances surrounding it in the next two sessions. And this is a big clue, and you will understand it more when we do the sessions than what you will at this moment, because I'm not going to take the time at this moment to explain to you the details, but I'm showing it to you anyhow. And that is, what is Zion or Zion? Now, this English word, S-C-I-O-N, it's quite obvious that it comes from the Hebrew, Zion, and the Z in Hebrew is a Zadi. And when this got rendered into Old English, the T-Z is how it's often rendered, the Zadi in Hebrew into English today. But in Old English, it got rendered, instead of T-Z, it got rendered S-C. S-C. If you look in Hebrews chapter 12, when it says, you've come unto Mount Zion, it's not Z-I-O-N, it's S-I-O-N. And so S-C-I-O-N is another way of spelling Zion. Now, what is Zion? What is Zion? It is grafting, where the Zion of a detached shoot or twig contains buds from a woody plant. How are the two houses going to come together? The answer is when you see Zion. And what is Zion? It is the grafting. It's when the graft takes place. Now, Brad teaching you the Hebrew language from agriculture. So what is grafting agriculturally? It's the method of plant propagation widely used in horticulture, where the tissues of one plant are encouraged to fuse with those of another. Grafting can only be done between reasonably closely related plants. You know what that means? That means Sunday and Saturday does not graft. That means Christmas and Easter doesn't graft with Passover and Tabernacles. They have to be reasonably closely related. Well, guess what? If Judah believes in the Sabbath, and Hebrew roots believes in the Sabbath, if Judah believes in the festivals and eating right, and Hebrew roots believes in the festivals and eating right, and if we believe the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and they believe in the covenant that was made with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, you know, even though for the moment we disagree who the Messiah is, we're reasonably closely related. We're graftable. But those who say, no, we don't care about the land, and we don't follow Torah, that ain't got a graft. And so it's that which doesn't graft are those who are candidates of being foolish virgins. So it says, In most cases, one plant is selected for its roots. That would be Yeshua the Messiah. He's the root. This is called the stock or the root stock. The other plant is selected for its stems, leaves, or flowers, and it is called the Zion, the Zion. Now, it's important for us to understand that the new covenant was only made with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. You know, the church says, yeah, we're members of the body of Messiah. We're the... That's how you become a member of His family. It is not based upon genealogy. Now, let's look at the situation today of the literal house of Jacob, who is personified by the Jewish people, and the redeemed house of Jacob, who's personified by what the world calls Christianity. Does the literal house of Jacob believe that Yeshua is the Messiah? Well, I know Jews that believe that Yeshua is the Messiah, but most Jews don't believe that Yeshua is the Messiah. What about the family, the redeemed family of the Messiah, commonly called Christianity? Do they believe that they should follow Torah? Well, some do believe they should follow Torah. Those that do, one of the descriptions we give for them is the Hebrew roots people. But most Christians don't believe that they should express their faith in Yeshua by keeping the Sabbath and the festivals and dietary laws and following Torah. So therefore, the house of Jacob is divided today because most of the literal house of Jacob don't believe that Yeshua is Messiah. And most of the redeemed house of Jacob don't believe that they should follow Torah. So how is this going to be resolved? It gets resolved through the ministry of Elijah. The ministry of Elijah. In Matthew chapter 17, the disciples ask Yeshua, why do the scribes or the rabbis teach that Elijah must first come or precede the Messiah? Yeshua said, Elijah truly shall first come and restore all things. He will come and restore all things. He shall come as future. Yep, he's coming. He's coming in the future. And this is what he's going to do. He's going to restore. You know what restore means? That means something originally was a certain condition, then something happened to it, but then you want to bring it back to how it originally was. So where do we have an original? Well, that's the Torah. And we walked away from it. Yeah, it's breaking the covenant. And then there's got to be a restoration back to Torah. The voice today that's being proclaimed in the body of Messiah, that we need to follow Torah? You know what we call that voice? The Hebrew roots of Christianity. Embracing our Hebrew roots. You see, and this message and this movement is evidence that Messiah is coming quickly. Why? Because what is the Elijah message? Malachi 4, 4, and 5. Remember the Torah of Moses. Behold, I send you Elijah the prophet. Why is Elijah the prophet being sent? He's being sent with the message of remember the Torah of Moses. You know what that means? In most Christian churches, Elijah is not welcome. Elijah is not welcome, or the Elijah message is not welcome, because he's got to come and say, you need to follow Torah. And they say, we don't follow Torah. Now notice, I'm going to send you Elijah the prophet before the coming and great and dreadful day of Yahweh. Before the day of Yahweh. Before the day of Yahweh. You know what the day of Yahweh is? It's the Messianic era. And the day of Yahweh has two parts, just like every day of Yahweh. Genesis chapter 1. It has an evening and it has a morning. What do we call the evening part of the day of Yahweh? The tribulation period. In other words, the tribulation period begins the Messianic era. It's the day of Yahweh. Why? Who's Yahweh that it's His day? It's the day of Yeshua, because it's in that day that He's glorified. It's in that day He sets up His kingdom. It's His day, the day of Yahweh. But notice, Elijah comes before that day. And so, we have the movement to embrace Torah and Hebrew roots that is preceding the coming of the Messiah. And this voice of Elijah is a voice crying in the wilderness. You know, if you ever think this message is going to become mainstream in the church, it's not. It's a voice crying in the wilderness. In the wilderness, that's where the Torah was given. A voice crying, follow Torah. A voice crying in the wilderness means, is anyone going to listen to me? Is anyone going to hear me? What is the outcome of the Elijah message and the Elijah ministry? The house of Jacob is restored and united. And we see this in Ezekiel 37:16. Son of man, take one stick. That word stick in Hebrew is eights. And eights in Hebrew means tree. It literally says in Hebrew, take one tree. Write upon it for Judah, the children of Israel, his companions. Then take another eights or another tree and write upon it for Joseph, the stick of Ephraim, for all the house of Israel, his companions. Anyone have any idea what tree this is referring to? It's an olive tree. Take one olive tree and another olive tree. And you know what you're going to do with these two olive trees? Join them together and make them one tree. One olive tree. And they will become one in your hand. Now, here is one of the places where the unification takes place at. I will make them one nation in the land. What land? The land of Israel. I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel. You know what the mountains of Israel is? The Bible calls it Judea and Samaria. The Western world calls it the West Bank. The unification of both houses of Israel takes place in the West Bank. Now, there's other places that the Bible says with the unification that the people go to. They go to Jerusalem, Jeremiah 51:50. Here they go to the mountains of Israel. In Zechariah in chapter 10, Bashan and Gilead and Lebanon. And where is Bashan and Gilead? Western Jordan today. Lebanon? Lebanon. Now the designated places for the unification to take place is in Jerusalem, the West Bank, Lebanon, Western Jordan, and actually southern Syria. And Israel is about to give away the mountains of Israel, make it a PLO state. They're ready to divide Jerusalem. So the places that are designated for the return isn't even in Israeli control today for the most part. And so I've had people ask, do you think I should go back to Israel today? Well, you know, first of all, if you're going back to Tel Aviv, the prophecies don't say that you're going to return and go back to Tel Aviv. You know, you're on your own if you go back to Tel Aviv. But if you want Yahweh's blessing, he says the mountains of Israel, Jerusalem, Lebanon, Bashan and Gilead. And I'll make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel. Do you see a problem that the unification being taken place on the mountains of Israel or the West Bank? There's a major problem because the present government of Israel wants to allow the mountains of Israel or the West Bank to become a PLO state. I was just in my room, turned on my computer, and today's Jerusalem Post, the Prime Minister of Israel says, we need to leave the West Bank. It's inevitable. We got to do it. We can't stay here. It's something we have to do. Today's Jerusalem Post. And so the Bible calls this conflict the controversy of Zion. Let's see how well you are a student of the modern peace process. In 1999, Clinton wanted to have a legacy before he went out of office because he had all types of problems while he was in office that he wants history to not regard. And so he called for the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, Ehud Barak, and Yasser Arafat, sat him down at Camp David because he wanted them to come to an agreement. And it is reported that Ehud Barak offered to divide Jerusalem, and he offered, 96% of the West Bank, an unprecedented Israeli offer. And it was not accepted by Yasser Arafat because while Ehud Barak offered to divide Jerusalem and 96% of the West Bank, he was not willing to allow the quote-unquote refugees to return back to a Palestinian state. And Arafat insisted, no deal unless the refugees return. So Arafat turned down the deal. I want you to understand what the significance of that is. It is, there was an issue of quote-unquote refugees, an issue of refugees that got displaced, exiled. Okay? That was the issue. Well, right now, this past week, President Bush has called for an international peace conference, Israel and the Palestinians and Arab countries. And right now, the last I heard, it's supposed to be in September in New York, unless they change their mind. And the peace has got to be based upon the Saudi peace initiative, the quote-unquote Saudi peace initiative, which is a return to 67 borders and negotiating over the refugees. Ultimately, in order for a deal to be made, Israel has to give in regarding the refugees. And I believe they will, because they're going to want to make a deal that badly, and there's going to be pressure from the international community to make a deal. Here's the irony of that. I believe that Israel is going to allow refugees to return to a Palestinian state, but after they make an agreement to do that, the God of Israel is going to go a-knocking, and he's going to say, you know what? I have a refugee problem. My refugee problem's about 2,700 years. And he's got to ask the nation of Israel, the government of Israel, do you recognize my refugee problem? They're going to say, a refugee problem? No, we're Jews. You don't. There's no refugee problem. And then he's got to go to the nations of the world. Do you recognize my refugee problem? The nations of the world, the United States government, the European Union, Russia, the United Nations. A refugee problem? Oh, I don't, there's no refugee problem. If we acknowledge a refugee problem, we're going to make the situation in the Middle East worse. No, there's no refugee problem. And so that parallels what Moses went to Pharaoh, and he said, let my people go. And Pharaoh said, there's a problem. I have to let some people go. What God's telling me to do this? Oh, the God of the Hebrews. Well, get that book out there. See if I know of any. I don't know no God of the Hebrews. And so the God of Hebrews says, I'm going to introduce myself to you. Let's talk. And so that's what's going to happen again. Yeshua the Messiah is going to say, oh, you don't acknowledge me? Let me introduce myself. I am the King of Israel. Because it says in Zechariah 14:1, in the day of Yahweh, verse 2, Jerusalem gets divided. And once Jerusalem gets divided, in the day of Yahweh, which I believe is a PLO state, then it says, he will fight against the nations as when he fought in the day of battle, and his feet will stand upon the Mount of Olives. And so it's going to be a replay of the showdown with Pharaoh. This is called the controversy of Zion. And then it says, David my servant will be king over them. They will have one shepherd. They will walk in my judgments, observe my statutes, and do them. You know how Judaism identifies the God of Israel? They say he's the King of the universe. And you know how Christianity identifies with Yeshua? He's the good shepherd. This says, one king, one shepherd. How both houses of Israel view Yahweh. And the king and the shepherd is Yeshua the Messiah, and they will follow his Torah. Walk in my statutes, observe my judgments, and do them. Now, in my last 15 minutes, I'm going to give you an overview of the 7,000-year plan of Yahweh, because this is foundational to understand the prophecies of the end of days of the two houses come together, which I'm going to be explaining to you in detail in the last two sessions I have with you at this conference. So we'll cover this foundation, and we'll use this foundation in our next two teachings. Remember, Brad shared with you that the end is told in the beginning. Isaiah 46:10, he declared the end from the beginning. Beginning is Reshit or Genesis. So what do we find in Genesis? We have that there was 7 days to creation. And we're told in Psalm 90, verse 4, that 1,000 years are likened unto yesterday. And in 2 Peter chapter 3, verse 8, it says, "Beloved, be not ignorant that one day is with Yahweh 1,000 years, and 1,000 years as one day." So each day in creation represented 1,000 years of time. The seventh day of creation was a day of rest. The seventh day of creation foreshadows the 1,000-year messianic era. The modern state of Israel was born in 1948. Then we go from Abraham to Isaac, Isaac to Jacob, Jacob to Egypt, 290 years. And now we see that Jacob went to Egypt, Levi's son went to Egypt, and Kohat, who was Levi. So Kohat went to Egypt, and from Kohat to Moses, there's just two generations. Moses is the grandson of Kohat. And Kohat went to Egypt. The rabbis say they were only in Egypt for 210 years. And so we have from Kohat to Amram to Moses to the Exodus, 80 years. They were in the wilderness for 40 years, to the death of Joshua, 30 years, that's 70. And now we go through the period of the judges, add those up. 450 years is which is what it says in Acts 13:20. And then we look to the kings of Judah, because after the judges were the kings of Judah, to the Babylonian exile, the kings of Judah, 513 years, the Babylonian captivity, 586. We add up these years, we come to right around 4,000 years. So is it something we theologically pull out of the air, there's 4,000 years from Adam to Yeshua? No, it can be biblically validated. And there's an illusion that Yeshua would come after 4,000 years. In the first verse of the Bible, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," which in Hebrew is Bereshit bara Elohim et. And so the word et is the fourth Hebrew word. It's et Elohim bara. No, it's et Hashemayim the et haaretz. So, et is the fourth Hebrew word. Remember, in Hebrew, you go from right to left. And et is Aleph and Tav. Who is the Aleph and the Tav? It's Yeshua. So, the fourth letter represents the 4,000 years till Yeshua would come. Yeshua is called the Alpha and the Omega, or the Aleph and the Tav. Revelation chapter 1 and verse 8. Now, the Sabbath is the seventh day of creation. Genesis chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. The Sabbath is the seventh day of creation. And then the seventh day Sabbath foreshadows the Messianic era. Because it says in 2 Peter 3:8, "Don't be ignorant that one day is with Yahweh 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day." Verse 10, "But the day of Yahweh." Don't be ignorant that one day is with Yahweh 1,000 years, and 1,000 years is one day. But the day of Yahweh. How long is the day of Yahweh? It's 1,000 years. And here we're told that the day of Yahweh comes as a thief in the night. The day of Yahweh comes in the night. The day of Yahweh comes in the night. You know what we call the night? The tribulation. The tribulation begins the messianic era. The Sabbath is the seventh day. Exodus chapter 20, verse 10. And the seventh day Sabbath is called the day of Yahweh. Isaiah 58:13. "If you turn away your foot from the Sabbath, from doing your pleasure on my holy day, and call the Sabbath the delight, the holy of Yahweh." So the Sabbath is called the day of Yahweh, or my holy day. Therefore, the eschatological Sabbath is called the day of Yahweh. Now, we're told in Isaiah 13, verse 6, that in the day of Yahweh is the time when pains and sorrows will take hold on them. In Zephaniah 1, 14 and 15, we say that the day of Yahweh is a day of wrath and trouble and distress. It describes the start of the day of Yahweh. That is the tribulation. And this day of Yahweh is called Jacob's trouble. That day is great. What day? The day of Yahweh. It's the time of Jacob's trouble, or the beginning of it. Now, I'm going to outline for you events that take place in the day of Yahweh. Zephaniah 1, 14 and 15, it says, in the day of Yahweh, Zephaniah 2:4, the Gaza shall be forsaken. How do you interpret that? It could be interpreted that the Jews got kicked out of the Gaza, living there, in August of 05. Right now, what happened is Hamas defeated Fatah, and the international community doesn't want anything to do with the Gaza because Hamas is there. So, whatever way you look at it, Gaza is being forsaken. So, this could be an argument that we are in the day of Yahweh now, that we have started Messianic times now, that we are in the tribulation now. But in my opinion, if one uses that argument, in order for me to conclude that we are in the tribulation, I need more evidence. Because if we are in the tribulation, I liken it to a woman who is in the early stage of her pregnancy. She knows that she's pregnant, but others around her may not. I need more evidence of things happening in the day of Yahweh to confirm to me we are in the tribulation. What are those significant events? Joel chapter 1 verse 15 says that in the day of Yahweh, the nations will part the land of Israel, or divide the land of Israel. Dividing the land of Israel. Now in Zechariah 14:1, in the day of Yahweh, all nations will come against Jerusalem, and half the city will go into captivity. That's dividing Jerusalem in the day of Yahweh. Now in the day of Yahweh, or Jacob's trouble, Jeremiah 30 verse 7, Yahweh says, I'm going to make a full end of all nations where I've scattered you, but I will not make a full end of you, but I will correct you and measure and not leave you altogether unpunished. So Jacob in exile is going to be punished, but he's going to be gathered, going to be redeemed. And in doing so, he's going to judge the nations in the day of Yahweh. In the primary nation or entity that gets judged is Babylon. Isaiah 13, the burden of Babylon. Verse 6, the day of Yahweh is at hand. And by the way, you know in the day of Yahweh how it says Babylon falls? Isaiah 13, verse 17 says they have a conflict with the Medes. You know what the area of the Medes is now? Iran and Iraq. So you know what I see in the world today? I see we have a conflict in Iraq, and we're preparing for one in Iran. At the same time, we're dividing the land of Israel and wanting to create a PLO state. Prophetically, those two things are related. They are both Day of Yahweh events. And then it says that the indignation of Yahweh will be upon all nations, for it's the day of Yahweh's vengeance for the controversy of Zion. Therefore, in the day of Yahweh, because of Zion and the controversy over Zion, that time is the day of his vengeance. Who's he take vengeance upon? The nations, for doing what? Dividing the land, dividing Jerusalem, and opposing Zion. Now, I got four more minutes. It says, Jeremiah 30, verse 17, I will restore health unto you, and I will heal you of your wound, because they called you an outcast. I only got three more slides. I will restore health unto you, and I will heal you of your wounds, because they called you an outcast, saying, this is Zion, whom no man seeks after. You see, when the world says to Zion, nobody follows after you. You're an outcast. He says, that's when I'm going to heal you of your wound. What is the wound? The wound is the exile. What's the healing of the wound? The end of the exile. Now in Psalm 102 verse 16 it says, when Yahweh builds up Zion, he will appear in his glory. Who's the one that appears in his glory? Yeshua, who is Yahweh. When he builds up Zion, that's when he's going to appear in his glory. But what is the building up of Zion? Psalm 147:2. Yahweh builds up Jerusalem. Jerusalem and Zion are synonymous terms. He builds up Jerusalem. He gathers together the outcasts of Israel. When he gathers together the outcasts of Israel, he will appear in his glory. When does he gather the outcasts of Israel? In the day of Yahweh? During the darkness part of the day of Yahweh. Because when it talks about Jacob's trouble and that day is great, Jeremiah 30 verse 7, the context of speaking about Jacob's trouble is Jeremiah 30 verse 3. says, Lord, the days come, says Yahweh, that I will bring again the captivity of my people, Israel and Judah. I'm going to cause them to return to the land that I gave the fathers, and they will possess it. Israel and Judah will return to the land. That day is great. It's Jacob's trouble. Israel and Judah return to the land during Jacob's trouble. And who helps to get them there is the prophecy in Jeremiah 16, verses 15 and 16, that Yahweh, after he sends for many fishers, he's been sending out fishers for 2,000 years, and this conference is a fishing conference. But you know what? I praise Yah that the place is as full as what it is, but you know what? There really should be 50 million people here. After I will send for many hunters. Who is a hunter? Esau is a cunning hunter. You see that fellow up there? He's a hunter. You see Bin Laden? He's a hunter. You see Al-Qaeda? He's a hunter. He's got to send for the hunters. And that is going to set us up for, and this is going to go along with, what Brad is going to continue to talk to you about, which is the wheat and the tares and Esau. He'll show it in one dimension, and we're going to pick up here in the next session. I'm going to describe to you that the end time battle is a battle between Jacob and Esau. I'm going to show you that the peace process is based upon UN resolutions. I'm going to show you that the redemption is likened unto a rebellion that's connected in principle with Hanukkah. And we're going to share with you some of these other details in the next two sessions. Let me repeat for those of you who's trying to take notes that all these slides, not only what I did, what I am going to do, is on a DVD at my table out in the marketplace, which if you're interested in getting, you can get after Shabbat. But that's got to conclude session two that I've shared with you, and I pray that it's been helpful to lay a foundation to understand who you are, because once you understand who you are in the work of Yeshua, then you can understand the prophecies of the two houses coming together and know how they relate and pertain to you, which is the goal. Shalom and Yeshua. Amen.